Good afternoon to all of you. Oh my. What would Mr. Pennelly say? Let's try that one more time. Good afternoon. Greetings to all of you. I bring you greetings from the Bloomington Normal and Canton and Springfield, Illinois congregations. It's very nice to be here in Steamboat Springs once again. My family and I were here last, I think, in 2003. So it's been a number of years since we've had the opportunity to be here. The prophet Jeremiah lived over 2,500 years ago. And by God's commission to him, he foretold the fall of Jerusalem and the nation of Judah. Jeremiah is the longest book in the Old Testament. And it is perhaps one of the least understood, even though it is one of the largest books in the Old Testament. At least it's misunderstood by theologians today quite frequently. Yet once we understand it, there are some of the most amazing prophecies in the entire Bible having to do with the future of Israel in it. So let's take a look at some of the lessons about the feast. First, we're going to look at the feast, and then I want to take a few minutes and talk about the Sabbath. Talk about the Sabbath day, and not necessarily the Sabbath day in detail, but some of the things about the Sabbath day in terms of lessons that relate to us as Christians. Each Sabbath, we hear sermons, and we hear sermons about how to be better Christians and how to walk the walk a little bit better. I want to talk about those, too, as we'll get to that a little bit later on, but I want to talk about some of the things that Jeremiah offers to us in his chapters 30 and 31 in the book of Jeremiah. I had some thoughts about Jeremiah and reading some of the things that he wrote and thinking about him a while back. And I was thinking, if God's prophets received military recognition today, it's my opinion Jeremiah would probably wear the Medal of Honor. Perhaps the Distinguished Service Cross, I don't know. I don't know whether you ever thought about it that way. What medals will Christians in the future wear? What, we used to call them a fruit salad, was what you wore in your uniform when I was in the Navy. It was all the ribbon area, which wasn't very extensive on my uniform. But on other uniforms, sometimes it was pretty extensive and it looked like a fruit salad because it was so colorful. So they called them a fruit salad. What kind of fruit salad or ribbons or whatever might your tunic in the kingdom of God bear on it? Certainly, and I hopefully will be wearing a crown, and on that crown we'll have a name written. And that, we might say, in a way, is part of our legacy. But there may be other forms of recognition by which we are known on your tunic or whatever. We'll have to wait and see. That's an interesting thing to contemplate, exactly how God will decorate his children, his kings, and his priests. As long ago as Jeremiah wrote, so much of what he wrote applies to us today and in the future, especially concerning the children of Israel. Jeremiah 30, if you'll turn over there if you haven't already, that's one of the first places I want to go. Jeremiah chapter 30 begins with Jeremiah being told by God that he was to write down the things that God told him in a book. Let's begin in chapter 30 here, though, with verse 1. It says, "The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Thus speaks the Lord God of Israel, saying, Write you all the words that I have spoken unto you in a book." And then he goes on from there in verse 3 to a time when God is going to begin to return the children of Israel and Judah from their captivity after the land of their forefathers, and they're going to return to Palestine and to the areas around Jerusalem and begin to repossess it. And we equate that time specifically with the 1,000 years, the reign of Jesus Christ in the millennium after his return. Then in verse 6, Jeremiah speaks of Jesus Christ on the earth and the millennial rule, but he talks and relates here in terms of a time just ahead of us when Israel is going to be in travail and suffering, or what we might call the Great Tribulation period for modern Israel. And then we have the famous statement in verse 7 of the time of Jacob's trouble comes along here as well. I'm not going to read through all of the verses. You can read a whole lot faster than I can. So I'm going to let you kind of peruse along in your Bible with me. I won't read all the verses, though. But we have that statement about Jacob's trouble. And then we find Jacob is going to be saved out of it. He's going to be spared. Not that Jacob, whose name was later changed to Israel, won't go through it, but he will be spared afterwards. They will be gathered up, those who have endured and survived. And then God is going to break the yoke of captivity off of the necks of his people. In verse 8, and David is, of course, going to be raised up to be their king, to rule over them again. And then in verse 9 again, even though Israel and Judah have been scattered in captivity, God says he'll correct them in measure. He's going to correct them in measure. And in verse 11, he's not going to leave them all together. Kind of skim through that area and see some of the things that he talks about doing for ancient Israel, or what we will call modern Israel at that point in time. And I think you can see pretty clearly what time period in the future this is going to be taking place. It's addressed talking about David being their king. Well, if David is in his grave, as we know him to be today, it's pretty obvious if he's going to be out of his grave and ruling in Israel, we're talking about the time after the first resurrection and the reign of Jesus Christ on this earth. Now, if you skip down to verse 16, God says he'll oppress those who oppress them, speaking of Israel. And then the fabulous promise that we find in verse 17. Let me read it. For I will restore health unto you, and I will heal you of your wounds, saith the Lord. Because they called you an outcast, saying, this is Zion, whom no man seeks after. Your God promises to heal and to repair the health of his people and their wounds. And the people of God, the temple of God, the church of God, could all well be referred to here, what he's talking about. And those healed of their wounds can certainly be those who are remaining as human beings who've survived the great tribulation and the captivity of the tribes of Israel. And they've been called an outcast people. Certainly if we look at the nations of the United States and Great Britain today and other nations of Israel, sometimes we're not very popular in the rest of the world. We aren't considered very approachable or very nice by most of the world. In fact, if we look at the rest of the world, they consider us to be an outcast people in many ways already. And Israel is going to be an outcast people at this time in the future, even having endured the Great Tribulation and coming out of that time. At least those who are not taken into a place of safety certainly will be. And even those taken to a place of safety will have already perhaps been so unpopular that they were cast out of the nations in which they lived to a place of safety. But that's another story. We can talk about the place of safety over half the afternoon. I don't want to talk about that today. God speaks specifically to the church, prophetically calling them Zion in many places in Scripture, whom no man seeks after. And certainly the people of God and the church of God today will not be very popular in the years to come. Revelation 12:6 and verses 12 through 14, a number of places speak of a time of persecution, things that are coming upon the church. Of course, this phrase at the end of verse 17 here in Jeremiah 30, this Zion whom no man seeks after, can be interpreted in several ways, a number of ways. Certainly the church of God won't be popular in modern Israel as she declines into more sinful practices. And the more we as a church spread an Ezekiel 33 warning message before this world, the less popular we're going to be. And the more hate and the more resentment that's going to come at us. But this also may refer to Zion physically, or where God or God's temple will stand in Jerusalem in the future. Ezekiel talks about that a little bit in Ezekiel chapter 37, I believe. Today, Jews and Christians alike look at Mount Moriah, and they believe that's where the next temple will stand. A recent survey by the Knesset television channel and the Panels Institute showed that 49% of the population of Israel today wants the temple to be rebuilt. And 42% believe it will be rebuilt. Now, those percentages have increased. They've done this survey over the years, and it's continued to grow every year, higher and higher percentage of the people thinking those things were going to occur. And when we look at Jeremiah 30 and verse 17, some find that this verse could be interpreted to mean that God won't put the temple precisely where everyone thinks it should go. Now, I don't know that that's necessarily the best or the best interpretation of it, but it could be, and it could end up perhaps that the temple's built in Zion rather than on Mount Moriah. We don't know. We'll have to wait and see, find out what God does. But when the millennium begins, there's going to be a huge turnaround. Everyone in the world is going to begin to look at Jerusalem, where Jesus Christ is reigning. The temple, the descendants of modern Israel who live in Palestine and all of that area around Jerusalem are going to come under a very close scrutiny by people all over the world. Israel will become the focus of where the saints, hopefully you and I, are teaching and showing people how to live. And they will be the focus of learning, that area of the world. You know, in the 17th and 18th century, Germany was the center, the focal point of the world for Christian learning, Christian teaching. Everyone went to Germany for their master's degrees and divinity degrees and divinity and theology and whatever. Just as in the early stages of the millennium, people, I feel, are going to come to Jerusalem and to Palestine for advanced education, to learn about God, to learn about why he's, well, about his reign and about what he's doing, and to learn how to live. Everyone's going to head that way. The question is, are all of those people of Israel and Judah prepared to take in people who are wanting to learn, to help them? Everyone is going to want to know a whole lot more about what Jesus Christ is doing and what he's saying all over this earth. Jerusalem is going to be the focus of how to live under his reign. People are going to come there from all over, at least in the initial years, and then perhaps other areas of the world will begin to develop that kind of training and teaching as well. The gospel of the kingdom spreads to the Gentile nations of the earth. Perhaps not quite as much focus is going to be right on the people in Palestine. You, brethren, will see how the model of teaching and instruction and rebuilding unfolds in Jerusalem under Jesus Christ. You're going to be given cities in which to teach and rebuild, pass on this, the teaching process, spreading the gospel on a slightly smaller scale in your 10 cities or your 5 cities or your 2 cities or your garage. Or, no, I'm just kidding. Hopefully all of us will have at least one city to learn how to pass those things on. Earlier, I promised you kind of a Sabbath lesson as well. It goes along with this. We talk about the cities and learning how to do these things. There are lessons that we need to learn today in order to take part in that teaching and that leading in the future. We've all probably thought about that. You know, how do we manage 10 cities? How do we manage 5 cities? What do we need to learn to be able to do that? A lot of things are necessary to learn. I look at that and I often, you know, I've always passed it off and said, well, hopefully I'll be a spirit being at that point, so it shouldn't be a problem. I should have all the abilities I need to be able to do that, and I'll learn everything I need to learn in a, you know, as quick as, you know, a flash. Unlike how long it takes me to learn things today. But it's not then that I'm really referring to. What I want to talk about is how prepared are you today? Not then. That's in the future. Hopefully you'll be a spirit being. But how do you prepare today, right now? Are you and I learning the lessons that we need to learn every day so that we're ready for our change when Jesus Christ returns? Will we be ready? Because what you and I learn today as we experience this life is what God wants to use to prepare you for the future, to be his spiritual children and his teachers of the future. We're all called here by God at the Feast of Tabernacles to learn about his purpose for us, his purpose for mankind, what the future holds, and what our part in the future is. Let's go back to Jeremiah, chapter 30 here. We'll talk about a few things here and kind of transition back into some Sabbath lessons here in a minute. But let's go to Jeremiah 30 and let's take a look at verses 18 through 20. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring again the captivity of Jacob's tents, and have mercy on his dwelling places. And the city shall be rebuilded upon her own heap, and the palace shall remain after the manner thereof. And out of them shall proceed thanksgiving, and the voice of them that make merry. And I will multiply them, and they shall not be few. I will also glorify them, and they shall not be small. Their children shall be as aforetime, and their congregation shall be established before me, and I will punish all that oppress them. A series of fantastic promises that God is talking about what he's going to do for modern Israel in that time, after the Great Tribulation and their return to the area around Jerusalem. Those coming from the various parts of the world, having been in captivity, some very unpleasant circumstances, many of them, may not even have tents to dwell in when Jesus Christ returns. But a rebuilding process will begin, in some cases right on top of the rubble of buildings that existed before. And these people will be thankful when they compare what they've been through with what they're now beginning to experience. Notice it says, and I will multiply them, and they shall not be few. They shall not be few. Kind of a fantastic promise about their growth. They're going to continue to multiply very quickly during the time of the millennium. Israel will become the prime focus of rebuilding and teaching. And as things stabilize in Israel, then they're going to have, I guess, what will be seen by the rest of the world is all of the things that the rest of the world wants to have. They're going to see what Israel has, the blessings that begin to flow in Palestine, around Jerusalem and in Jerusalem. The rest of the world is going to see that. The rest of the Gentile world is going to see it and want to know, what do we need to do to have that, to live that way, to see how those things are done. And they're going to want to learn how to do that. Now, if you keep your finger in Jeremiah 30, I'm going to go over and do one more verse here. Or, well, maybe two verses, and then we'll come back. Let's go to Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah 14. Although this has been read, this verse already. I thought I'd read it again in a slightly different light. I think Mr. John Pennelly read it. Zechariah 14, verse 16. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. I think we've all read that verse many, many times. And all peoples and all Gentiles are going to seek to come up to Jerusalem, to the Feast of Tabernacles. They're going to learn the way of life that made Israel and the tribes of Israel so happy and made their lives so unusually different in a pleasant way. They're going to find out how is this done? How do we teach others to do that? Or how do we learn how to live that way? Let's go over to Habakkuk as well. Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 14, just back a few pages in your Bible. Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 14. For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That knowledge, those cities, that teaching that you are all carrying to others and teaching others about is going to spread all over the earth. People are going to begin to see it, and they're going to begin to say, I want that. I want to live that way. I want to see how you did that. How can I go up to Jerusalem and learn how to do that or to begin to live that way? Let's go back to Jeremiah 31 again. Jeremiah 31 and verse 1. Jeremiah 31 and verse 1. At the same time, saith the Lord, will I be the God of all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. God declares that he's going to be the God of the families of Israel. Now, I have always looked at the Feast of Tabernacles as a family feast. Then God is a, shall we say, or should I be so bold as to say that God is a family man? Not man, but he's a family God, I guess is maybe the way to put it. It isn't just his desire to rule over the nations and over all of the earth and to rule over, the church and over Israel. It's his desire to rule in every household, within every family. And here's where the feast kind of boils down to us in on an everyday Christian lesson, I think, for each of us. The Feast of Tabernacles is a family feast. As a boy, 9 years old, I think, is when my family began to attend church many years ago, growing up. I saw the Feast of Tabernacles as the most exciting and fun time of the year. Or at least I learned that after attending the first couple of them. I loved it far more than anything that the world had to offer. For somebody 9 to 13 years old during those years of my life, it was probably the most fun that could be had in one place at one time on the face of the earth. When I wasn't swimming in the water, and surfing at Jekyll Island, the hurricanes brought in fantastic waves. You couldn't find me anywhere except on the beach in the water. When I wasn't on the beach in the water, then I was usually dressed up in services, resting up so that I could go swimming again right after. And I would ask every parent here to see to it that the feast is such a time of enjoyment for your children. Make it something your children will never want to give up. I want to tell you a story about my coming into the church, I guess, or my first contact with the church through my parents many years ago. It was 1957, and my parents were invited to meet two gentlemen who had come out on a baptizing tour from Pasadena. And Bryce Clark was one of them. I'm not sure who the other one was. I don't remember now. But I was about 9 years old. And they came on a visit and said, met my mom at a lake very near, maybe about an hour's drive from our home. And my dad had taken sick. He had a real bad flu, so he stayed home. Was disappointed he wasn't going to get to meet him. So she went out to the lake, and was one of the last ones that they talked to. Of course, they like to meet at lakes because if you're going to do baptizing, that's rather handy to have water, real handy. So she went out to the lake to meet them and to talk with them for a little while. And then after they had finished baptizing a number of people and talking with people, they talked with my mom and found out my dad had planned to come but couldn't. And they were now pretty much free. And they said, well, we can come over to your house. So she said, well, if you really want to do that, fine. So they came over to the house. And I was at home with Dad. And they arrived in the evening there, and it came time for bed for me, so I headed off to bed. But, of course, my bedroom was at the end of the hallway, and I could hear right straight down into the living room where they were at. So I stood in the darkness rather than going to bed for a little while and listened until I got tired and went to bed. Well, about midnight, there was a huge racket in the house. I couldn't figure out what it was. Nothing had ever awakened me like that before as long as I lived. And all this noise, I got up and the hall light was on, and the kitchen light was on, and I went down the hall, and these gentlemen had left, and my parents were in the kitchen, and they were taking pieces of meat out of the freezer and grinding them up in the garbage disposal. That was my first contact, really, with the church. So I knew that my parents had lost their minds. Even at 9 years old, I could figure that out. I think you know what kind of meat it was that was going down the garbage disposal. Let's go back to Jeremiah. I don't want to get too carried away with tall tales here. Let's go to Jeremiah 31 and verse 4. He says again, I will build you, and you shall be built, O virgin of Israel. You shall again be adorned with your tabrets and shall go forth in the dances of them that make merry. There will come a time again when Israel will dance. We have a family dance this evening. There will be great celebration at this time and dancing among the descendants of Israel and Palestine as they settle near Jerusalem, with their king and their high priest, Jesus Christ, and David under him, and the 12 apostles under him. Verse 5, you shall yet plant vines upon the mountains of Samaria. The planters shall plant and shall eat them as common things. The land of Israel today is not very fertile. You know, you don't grow grapevines in desert soil very well. Takes an awful lot of work, an awful lot of watering, awful lot of fertilizing to do so. And eventually this fertility and this abundance of crops and the things that are going to be there will become common and expected. It's nothing like that today. It's really hard to grow things there. But in the millennium, it's going to be common, expected. Today, the desert is a very unlikely place to find grapevines. But when the land will be returned to what it once was, and perhaps we'll have a time when two men will have to carry a single bunch of grapes on a pole between them, as it once was. Verse 7, for thus saith the Lord, sing with gladness for Jacob, and shout among the chief of the nations, publish you, praise you, and say, O Lord, save your people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I will bring them from the north country and gather them from the coasts of the earth, and with them the blind and the lame, the woman with child, and her that travails with child together. A great company shall return thither. They shall come with weeping, and with supplications will I lead them. I will cause them to walk by the rivers of waters in a straight way, wherein they shall not stumble. For I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. Certainly the blessings on a repentant people of Israel will be cause for a great rejoicing. Indeed it will be. And verse 8 reiterates this great future exodus of the survivors of modern Israel back into their own land of Israel. There are not a lot of rivers in Palestine today, but there will be then in the millennium when God begins to bless the land that they dwell on. We could go on here and read all kinds of things about Israel in the future and the wonderful things that God is going to do in the millennium to bring the land back to his people. But we need to stop here. We need to ask a question. We need to ask, actually, probably several questions about our part in it and the Sabbath lesson that I promised. What will you and I be doing? What will our part in this future be? The prophet Ezekiel had a vision of the land of Israel in the future. I mentioned it earlier in Ezekiel 47, I think verse 13 is where it starts. And I don't have time to read hardly anything in Ezekiel. It's a huge subject. But it provokes a question, talking about this remnant of Israel returning to the land. Are all of these people returning from all parts of the earth, as we just saw in Jeremiah 31, verse 8, all these people returning to the land, are they just going to kind of walk in and plop down and stake a claim? I don't think so. The sons of God, acting on the instructions of Jesus Christ, are probably going to help the people settle on the land, to maybe issue the land to the various tribes. Perhaps one of our first jobs after peace has been restored and the rebellion put down on this earth as Christ begins his rule will be to help these people settle on the land, to learn how to grow things again. And these people are going to need help with the necessities, the basics of life, every little thing that they won't have. They may not even have tents to live in. At the time, there are going to be a lot of things that they have need of right away. We'll have a lot of work to do and a lot of teaching to do. Are you ready to help them? Those who are in the first resurrection will be the teachers, will be the helpers, will be the people that will help them settle. But how can we possibly expect to have a part in all of this, in terms of what the prophets foretell, what the Bible predicts about the future as kings and priests and teachers? How can we have a part in that if we cannot now become the godly people that Jesus Christ would have us be? How on earth can we expect to be part of this? How on earth can we expect to have this kind of future and to be the teachers and the kings and the priests? That question should give us pause. Are we the godly people that we need to be in order to take part in all this, in order to be ready for our change? With the world in rubble, are you ready to lead others in reconstruction and in mending their broken lives? The answer to those questions in our Sabbath lesson is really found in the Greek language in which the New Testament was originally written. There are several words, in fact, a whole family of words in the New Testament Greek, that were in transition during the time of Jesus Christ and the apostles. The words are changing and then being changed during that time from how the ancient Greek wording used them in the worship of their gods and goddesses, to how the New Testament apostles would use them in the Greek of the New Testament regarding the Christian. That transition was taking place. A lot of people don't realize it, but the Apostle Paul is one of those individuals who changed words, moved the meaning of words from the ancient Greek into the Koine or common Greek of the day that he used to write his messages to us. And sometimes it's very interesting to look at the changes that he made in some of the words that he used. And I want to begin with a unique example or a unique word that Paul uses. It's an illustration most of you will probably be familiar with. It's found in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 9. Let's go over there for a minute. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 9. Hebrews 4 and verse 9. He says, there remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God. A rest for the people of God. Many of you will be familiar with the verse. The Greek word underlying the English word for rest is sabbatismos. Sabbatismos. And you probably don't have to be a Greek scholar to figure out that that word has something to do with the Sabbath, doesn't it? Sabbatismos. But it's a unique word. It's used only once in the New Testament. And up until this time, the word had one meaning in ancient Greek, basically keeping of days of rest. That's all it meant, keeping of days of rest. Paul is using it in a unique way, and even most theologians and scholars accept the fact that Paul is using the word in a unique way, that it has more meaning now as Paul uses it in the New Testament than it ever had before in the ancient Greek. And by the way, ancient Greek and Koine Greek are quite different. A person who understands one is not always able to understand the other, just like modern Greek is a completely different language as well. Why was Paul inspired to use this one word once in the New Testament? Well, it simply meant a keeping of days of rest to the ancient Greeks, but Paul uses it in a unique light in terms of the Sabbath day. Scholars don't like to admit it, but they realize that he's doing something different with that word, and they don't quite know why. But he's engaged in showing that the people of God are Sabbath keepers. They're keeping the Sabbath. So scholars tend to avoid this verse as best they can. That's a quick example of one word used by Paul. We're going to look at some other words used by Paul, and one in particular that's used only once in the New Testament as well, where Paul changes the meaning of a word. The words I want to look at specifically today are translated as typically godliness or godly. We're going to talk about being godly people and walking a life of godliness. But sometimes different Greek words are all lumped together and they're all translated as godliness. In fact, there are several words that are used as godliness in the New Testament. All we see is godliness in the English. So I want to go through a few of those and kind of clarify some of the meanings here that we may have missed in our English translation. The root word in Greek for that's used here frequently, it's the root word or the part of the word that's used for godliness is sebomai. Sebomai. And it means to stand in awe, to venerate, to reverence, to worship, to adore. And its noun form can basically be translated as someone who is devout or pious. I don't like the word pious very much. It has too much sticky Protestant attachment to it, so I try to avoid it as best I can. But it also is part of this family of words. And the word that's most often translated in the New Testament as is used most often as godliness in the New Testament is eusebia. Eusebia, it's spelled E-U-S-E-B-E-I-A. E-U-S-E-B-E-I-A. And we pronounce that a little differently in English, but it's eusebia in Greek. And it's made up of two words. E-U, the first two words, is one word in Greek, and it means good or well. And the second part, sebeia, means to worship or a way of life. To worship or a way of life. So if you put the two together, you have kind of a well worship or a good worship, or we might even say a perfect worship or a proper worship, maybe. Number of different ways you could probably take the literal meaning. And so it's good worship or well worship. Let's go see how that word is used in the New Testament. It's used in a number of places. I'm only going to look at two. One of them is in 2 Peter. Let's go there. Because it's an important aspect of how this word is used. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 11. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 11. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? And godliness there is this word eusebia, or eusebia. Peter draws a conclusion here in this second book that he wrote as he urges the key, or urges the church with a question, or a key question, if you want to put it that way. Since all of this physical world is going to be dissolved one day, what kind of people should we be who look for the coming of the Lord? What kind of people should we be? Very important question. And that's my primary question for us today. What kind of people should we be? A most important question. He uses the terms holy conduct and godliness in this verse. Peter's saying that this is where it's all at. This is what it boils down to. This is Peter's last book. This is his last shot at the church, so to speak. Is everything in your Christian life and your conduct coming together into godliness? We could ask it that way. Eusebia, or proper worship of God, is not how pious we appear, but how we actually walk the Christian walk before God. That's what godliness is. It is our best form of worship of God, our most powerful form of worship that God can receive from us, is for us to walk like Jesus Christ did. That's godliness. Sometimes we wonder, what's the term godliness mean? It seems to take in an awful lot. Well, yes, it does. It takes in the whole picture. Everything about your walk, everything about the way you live, that's the best worship we can give to God. And it's the best definition of godliness that I think I've found anywhere. It's the perfect Christian walk, so to speak. It's the best possible worship that God can ask of us, to imitate his Son. Let's go to 1 Timothy, because this is where Paul addresses the same thing. Timothy, in a different way, uses godliness in a quite different way here. 1 Timothy chapter 4 uses the same word here again. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 7 and 8, but reject profane and old wives' fables and exercise yourself toward godliness. There's that word, eusebia. For bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable for all things, having promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come. That's what it all boils down to. And now we find Paul emphasizing the same word, good worship or well worship or proper worship. You know, over the last year or two, I think I've probably heard more rumors that I don't ever want to hear again. Maybe they aren't old wives' fables, but they amount to the same thing. I don't have time for those anymore. I hope you don't either. There's too much I have to do to get ready. There's too much we all have to do to get ready to enter that kingdom. I don't have time for those things anymore. I want to be part of that millennium reign. How badly so many people need guidance. How many need teaching? How many will need reliable kings and priests? Think about how many of you want to be part of what Christ is doing in that day. It ought to make us all want and strive to be men and women of godliness. You know, at home I have several four-drawer files in my office. And a few weeks ago I went looking through the files. I don't think there's very many files that you could find where I didn't have some kind of an article of some kind that I'd clipped out at some time in the past about almost any subject imaginable. And I thought, I ought to look in my files and see if there's been anything written by the church over the past 20 years or more on the subject of godliness. And when I went through the file, there's nothing there. I've got a file in there called godliness, and it's empty. Nothing. I thought it kind of strange, maybe, that we haven't talked about the subject of godliness in the church for many, many years. Now, either I've missed it, and I didn't clip it out, or we haven't talked about it very much. I think I've only given one sermon on it. But it is something that is very important for the feast, especially in the Sabbath during the feast, considering the pattern of godliness parallels the pattern of God's feast days. Now let's take a look at another noun. It's translated as godliness in the New Testament. Just one time. It's another one of these words that Paul brings around to us, but only uses it one time in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul introduces the word to us in 1 Timothy. It was a word used by the Hellenistic Jews to describe their proselytes, but not really found commonly in any Greek writings. Paul, being, of course, very well trained in Judaism and also being an excellent Greek speaker, he lifts this word out of the Greek past, bringing it forward into the New Testament, just once in his writings. And I believe he's introducing a little-known Greek word with previous unfamiliar meanings as a new word with now new Christian meaning. Very much for us today. Just as he did in Hebrews 4:9 with the word sabbatismos. And he brings this new word forth to the attention of the ladies in particular. So if I didn't have the ladies' attention at the beginning when I started talking about Greek, maybe I do now. I've never pictured Paul as much of a ladies' man, but I've obviously been mistaken, because he was. This new noun that Paul introduces is in 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 through 10. 1 Timothy chapter 2. Verses 8 through 10. He begins, he says, I desire, therefore, that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting, in the manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Godliness with good works. Paul is hoping that women will shift focus away from outward adornment. And where will they place that emphasis? In godliness. Women who profess godliness have fruits of it in the form of good works. Maybe men aren't quite as capable of that perfect form of godliness. I don't know why Paul only introduces it here once with the ladies. I think the men probably should pay attention too. Paul preserves and reserves this one reference to this word, theosabia. Sabia, remember, means worship. Theosabia. Theosabia. You're looking to spell it. Theos in the Greek means God. So it is God worship this time. God worship. What we might simply call godliness. The best form of worship we can provide to God is to walk in godliness as his son did. Because the true worship of God is godliness. It's our walk. It's how we behave. It's how we live every day before him. What is the true worship of God? Theosabeia, godliness. He introduces this word. I think the Apostle John maybe expresses the worship of God a little bit to us in a way that's familiar. In John 4:24, he says, God is a spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. We heard a little bit about truth yesterday in the sermon, didn't we? These thoughts are connected. Every time I think about those things, they all seem to fit into the package of godliness. And Paul is probably at this point maybe frustrated with using the same old word for godliness, because that same old word has been used by the ancient Greeks many times to refer to their gods and goddesses. And he says, let's not use that word anymore. It's got too much attachment to an old way of life, to a wrong way of life. He says, let's call it theosabeia. Let's use a different word. Let's talk about godly worship, the way God would really have us worship. Paul points to us using the Spirit of God to walk in godliness every day before God. How many of us can say that we do that? If we could, the bride would be ready. But I don't think we can all say that. Paul's introduction of this word to the New Testament is significant. I think he's trying to say that this kind of worship is the only pure kind of worship of God that is untarnished by the way the Greeks worship their gods and goddesses. It's untarnished from the world, uninfluenced by its evil, separate from the world, just as we have an opportunity at the feast to be separate from the world for a short time. Untarnished from that old way of life, so to speak. The kind of worship and perfect walk that all of the Old Testament prophets, including Jeremiah that we read and others, wanted ancient Israel to perform. But ancient Israel never did. Never really walked in perfect godly worship. And so the women of the New Testament are urged by him to seek this kind of godliness and to let it be reflected in their works, in their lives, in their walk with God. But I think I'd be remiss if I said it was just for the women that Paul addressed this. It's for all of us. We're all urged by Paul to seek a perfect form of godly worship. A godly life filled with the works of godliness in it, because the most perfect form of worship that we can have of our God is in how we walk and how we live every day. And if that walk is in godliness, then that is the most powerful form of worship that we can show and give to our God. My life falls far short. I suspect most of yours do too. My life isn't perfect. Every year I strive to change things, and sometimes I succeed and improve a little here, sometimes fall back a little there. This is the kind of worship that Israel never achieved. They were never able to have. But modern Israel of the future in the millennium will experience and desire to have those of us who lived before, who are now the children of God. They'll want us to explain to them how we lived. Did we live in godliness? Theosabeia? Will they see it in how we lived? I hope we can teach people. It's hard to be a teacher when they look at your past life and say, "Ooh, is that how you lived?" How are we going to pass things on to people in the future when they figure out who we were before and how we lived before? Can we conclude this Feast of Tabernacles with a perfect form of godliness, being what we will strive to live by over the next year? Can we commit to that? Can God have your commitment today to strive to do so? Can we let go of the rumors and the unkind words and the accusations and the mistrust and the anger and the jealousy and the vanity and the selfishness of the past? Can we let all of those things go and say, none of that's important? Like Paul says, profess godliness with good works, Is that the way our next year of life is going to be? Perfect godliness, theosabeia. Perfect worship, godly worship, as God desires it. What manner of persons ought we to be? Can you and I go home after the feast and be committed to living a godly life reflected in the works of godliness? In all that we say and do, and in our walk before God every day for the next year, you have to ask yourself that question. I hope so. Enjoy the rest of the feast, brethren, but commit yourself to live in a pattern of godliness that will be the perfect form of worship of our great God.